to know.
Come on, wouldn't you want to know what's at the bottom of Lake Washington? We're going to find out this hour. Good morning, I'm Bill Radke. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. This hour, do Seattle TV stations have the right to surveillance video of the SPU shooter? Do Washington State towns have the right to ban marijuana? And should we pay voters to vote? That and more all coming up. First, though, a question. This week, we found out some of what's on the bottom of Lake Washington. What do you know is on the bottom of the lake because you put it there? Let us know on Facebook, as people are right now. Our guest this hour, Knute Berger, you're the Mossback at Crosscut.com and Seattle Magazine columnist. Have you deposited anything for safekeeping in Lake Washington, Knute?
It's not at the bottom, but I left my adolescent pride in Lake Washington. So
really?
Oh, yeah.
Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger.
I've from time to time, when caught out on a boat on Lake Washington, particularly the electric boats that you only get for a certain amount of time and you're out there, I guess that's Lake Union, but it connects. I've added some water to the lake.
Yes. In that sense, haven't we all left something in Lake Union? Maria Laganga, you're Seattle bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times, and you just revealed a few minutes ago before we went on the air that you're afraid of water, and you've moved up here very recently.
I don't like water. I stay as far away as I can get. It's hard to wash your face in the shower.
That's coming up. We're going to talk more about that in a few minutes, and we want to hear from you on Facebook, KUOW Public Radio, Twitter at KUOW, on the phone at 206-685-2526. That's 685-BLAM. If you don't want marijuana, do you have to have marijuana? This week, the Washington State Attorney General's office laid out its argument in a court case involving the city of Fife. Fife has banned marijuana businesses. Someone who wants to open a pot store there says, "You can't outlaw it. We legalized it. It's a state right." So they're suing Fife. Eli Sanders, there are two ways Fife could win this argument, and one of them could potentially bring down the whole legal pot thing?
That's right. So one of the arguments that Fife, which is a city near Tacoma, is making is that the state has a law legalizing pot, but hang on, the federal government considers marijuana to be a Schedule I controlled substance. It's still illegal on federal property here in Washington State. The state did something that runs afoul of federal law, and so it should be invalidated by the federal government. And if that argument goes through, then the whole legalization scheme in Washington falls apart. And so the ACLU and the state of Washington, which have intervened in this case, which is in Pierce County Superior Court, are saying, no, we don't think federal law invalidates this. And by the way, the federal government has basically said we're going to let these experiments in Washington and Colorado go forward. So I don't know how far that one will get, but if Fife gets its way on that one, then it's not just Fife that will get rid of pot and pot stores, or legal pot and legal pot stores. Mm-hmm. It will be the entire state of Washington, and we'll have wasted a tremendous amount of time setting up this distribution system and debating it and voting on it. The other argument is that, well, okay, the state law is legal, but cities have a right to opt out. And on this particular argument, the state and the ACLU diverge. The state of Washington and the attorney general says, yeah, that's true.
Go ahead, opt out.
Sure. If you don't want the, you know, revenue from this, the tax revenue, the business revenue, go ahead and opt out. I'll put an asterisk there because I want to come back to something. But the ACLU says, no, every city in the state has to follow the law, and the law as we understand it is that it's legal to have a pot store, and so whether you're Fife or anywhere else, you have to allow people to open pot businesses.
Which I don't quite get. I mean, don't cities, there are dry cities and counties, there are cities that don't allow, I don't think there are strip clubs in the city of Seattle, right? I don't think you can play blackjack, don't I have to go to Shoreline still? In other words, can't cities just not do stuff they don't want to do?
Well,
even if it's legal, legal elsewhere in the state?
It's actually, the way I would see it is individuals right now have a right not to open a pot store if they don't want to. But if they do want to, the state law says they can in any city in the state. And so the fight is over whether a city can prevent them from doing that. But you're saying do individual cities have a right to enact like zoning ordinances that prohibit activities that are illegal statewide.
Yeah, it's not quite a right. I mean, you have to license these pot stores. It seems a little far-fetched, but do you disagree?
Well, I mean, in terms of my opinion, I think that everyone in the state should follow state law. But in terms of creative ways of zoning businesses out of a city, I think there's probably a way that Fife could do this without going directly at the state law.
Canute, what do you think?
Well, the way you would control it would be through zoning. In other words, but if you have a law that explicitly says that an activity is licensable, and the argument is, well, you should be able to do that in any city, and they shouldn't be able to get in your way, except to the extent that they can zone for schools or whatever and that kind of thing. But it is interesting because there's a lot of complexities in the arguments that are being made versus. I mean, most liberals would say that the federal law is certainly in civil rights cases and whatnot to trump state laws. Yet we're saying in terms of marijuana, state law, we believe in states' rights when it,
right.
when it comes. We have plenty of legal products like coal and oil that people are protesting them, blocking trains and doing that kind of
thing. Yeah, which we'll be talking about this hour.
So we're saying it's a legal product, but we have the right to ban it from, moving through our state. So, I mean, I think I've always felt that the legalization of marijuana, it's inevitable. It's going to happen. I think it'll happen in most of the country, if not all. But it's going to be this, series of really complex and interesting legal definitions that get made along the way.
Maria, what do you think?
I have a couple of big questions about this. One is, because you can do something, do you have to do something? So, I mean, does the law mean allowing something means, is that an affirmative requirement?
The ACLU thinks so in this case.
Well, I guess that we're going to find out in court. And the other big question I have is sort of the opposite of that. If you make something legal, but then don't make it available, is it really legal? Which is the question, for example, with Roe v. Wade. It's legal federally, but there are states throughout the country saying, we don't want it here. And they are allowed to do that. And
right.
as you point out, with prohibition, it made alcohol legal across the country in 1933, but there are still states where and counties and cities where you can't drink. But there are 17 states, I believe, where you can't have a dry county. So they went at it a little differently.
Ah, Eli.
On this question of what's required, I don't think that ACLU would say that Fife is required to have a pot store, but they would say that if a business person in Fife wants to open a pot store and has a state license to do it, then they have a right to open that store if there is a place that's suitably zoned for it in the city of Fife. So it's not that Fife has to make a pot store available. They can, if no one in Fife wants to open a store, people in Fife can drive to Tacoma.
Right.
If Tacoma has a store. One of the interesting wrinkles, Canute was talking about all the various complexities in this, and an interesting wrinkle here is this question of, okay, well, if Fife succeeds in asserting its right to ban pot stores, but the state law stands, and the state is collecting revenue from stores all over the state, but not in Fife, and then doling that revenue back out statewide to projects, including highways, say, that maybe run through Fife or serve Fife. Should Fife get an equal cut of the pot revenue,
right,
even though it's banned pot stores? There was a bill that was discussed last session, and I hope it will come back up this session, that addresses this from a different direction. Okay, you don't want pot stores? Are you saying you don't want any state pot revenue also?
It's a little red hand. Will anyone help me legalize marijuana? Not I, said Fife.
We'll only have highways where people are stoned.
Another little wrinkle this week. The state busted the weed bus. This is a company that drives you to the pot store and drives you around while you smoke on the bus. Nope. State says, can't do that.
Why?
Well, a couple of things. For one, they said that you can't permit a driver to be exposed to the smoke, except they also said it's in view of the general public. I sort of get the exposing the driver thing, but I don't really get the in view of the general public, since you can smoke a cigarette in a car. I don't know why you can't.
Darken the windows.
Darken the windows, exactly. And finally, quick thing, remember the one Seattle officer who wrote 80% of the tickets for public pot smoking, supposedly flipped a coin to decide who to cite, and wrote sarcastic comments in the citations? Our new police chief, Kathleen O'Toole, is okay with him. He's back on the beat. and seen. More wrinkles to come in pot world. We're going to find out. I wonder if there's pot at the bottom of Lake Washington. We found out some of the stuff that's down there this week. One of the most popular clicked, read, listened to stories we've done in years on KUOW. And in case you missed it, we'll fill you in coming up on the Week in Review. Good morning with LA Times Seattle Bureau Chief Maria Laganga and the Strangers Eli Sanders and Crosscut's Knute Berger. I'm Bill Radke bringing you the Week in Review. China wants to burn American coal. Is Washington State going to ship it to them? Maybe. We'll tell you about that in a few minutes. But first, coal is one of the least creepy things sitting at the bottom of Lake Washington, which we know now because KUOW reporter Sarah Waller got on a boat and asked some divers what's down there. Sarah, welcome to the Week in Review.
Hi, thanks.
Why were you snooping around under our lake?
Well, it was part of a new series that KUOW has launched called Local Wonders, where listeners write in the questions that are burning on their minds and vote on which ones they most want to see covered. And the one that was picked most recently was what's on the bottom of Lake Washington. One of our listeners had heard that there are rumors that it was 1,000 feet deep and that there was old logs sitting out there, maybe an ancient forest, and she wanted to know more.
A pod of aquatic yetis down there, who knows? So I mentioned coal, so let's get that out of the way. How come there's coal on the bottom of the lake?
Well, apparently it's one of the oldest wrecks that's down there. And this is from a barge that was taking coal out of Newcastle into Seattle. You know, Seattle used to be fueled by coal. Gasworks Park used to turn it into gas. And a storm hit it about 140 years ago. This is the barge. And it took the whole barge carrying about 12 coal cars down to the bottom of the lake, in the middle of the lake, just south of the 520 bridge. And apparently you can dive down there now. And those cars and the barge, they're still sitting at the bottom, upright, full of coal. Still down there. It's like a time capsule. Apparently it looks a lot like the day it sank. You can see the wood and the rivets and the metal wheels.
China wants to come over and burn that coal.
Yeah.
Can you burn waterlogged coal?
I guess so. To get some salvage rights.
There are like 400 boats down there.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah. Well, so there's kind of two kinds of boats down there that I found out about. There are historic boats, like these giant Navy minesweepers. There are three at the bottom of the lake. I mean, picture, these are, I think, five-story boats. I mean, huge. Three of those. And then there's old ferry boats and tons of boats like that. But then also modern pleasure boats that have met kind of an untimely end. Mm. And a lot of the boats are concentrated off Carillon Point in Kirkland, which is the site of the old Lake Washington shipyards. And some of these boats are in such shallow water and so huge that they've actually had to come and chop the tops off the boats so that the modern boats that are plowing over these things every day have enough clearance to actually get over these 180-foot boats that are still sitting right out there in the mud, some of which people can even swim to, apparently.
Wow. By the way, Washington State Ferry System, we don't have enough ferries. There are some full-size ferries right down there, right within grabbing distance. So sometimes these were not accidents, right? I heard in your story that some of these boats were just, they'd get sunk purposely.
Yeah, apparently there's this long age-honored tradition of scuttling boats in Lake Washington. And so this would happen when people would have a boat that was no longer useful to them, you know, 100 years ago. And instead of paying to have it taken out of the lake, they'd take it out to the middle of the lake and pull the plug and sink it. And that's still happening. The divers say that when they go down, it's not uncommon they'll run across yachts that just last week would have had anchor holes smashed in their hulls, concrete cinder blocks put in the back. Mm. And they say it's pretty creepy that great lengths have been taken to make sure that these yachts cannot be identified, the numbers rubbed off and things like that.
I'm glad you brought up the word creepy, reporter Sarah Waller. I mean, you're taking on an assignment like what's at the bottom of Lake Washington. You're going to find some creepy answers. And one of the divers you talked to definitely feels the weird.
There are trash bags all over the lake. They're on the wrecks, they're next to the wrecks. They'll be swimming around and just bump into one. And that's just something that creeps me out. I just don't open them.
Yeah. So I've got to ask, did the subject of missing people come up when you were talking about what's down there?
Yeah, that was something I definitely asked them about. And they said that occasionally there are drowning victims that get found at the bottom of the lake. And they say it's actually a lot more common to run into that in Lake Union. For them, I think one of the divers had found personally a body, but I believe that was also in Lake Union. Mm-hmm. What they had come across apparently are some urns once in a while, people
sure.
who intentionally have had probably a ritual burial in the lake. And then also they said there was a medical specimen, and this was really difficult for me to hear as a parent, but of a baby that was in a plastic bag
sure.
from a leading medical facility in Seattle that had been disposed of in the lake
yep.
and sunk to the bottom. And so for things like that, they get law enforcement involved, and it's not the kind of thing they want to find at all.
Now, in your story, you mentioned a couple things that you didn't have time to elaborate on, but I want to know more. For one thing, two underwater forests?
Yeah.
What's an underwater forest?
So apparently these are from landslides that happened about 1,000 or so years ago here. And one is located right off of Mercer Island. And the other one is up in Kenmore off of St. Edward's Park. And these are huge, huge old growth trees that just slid into the lake. And the larger one is the Mercer Island one. And there's about 100 trees still standing down there.
Are they growing? Do we know? Are they alive? No, right?
No.
Okay.
But people have tried to harvest them, actually.
Oh,
there was
yeah.
somebody who went to great lengths to try and draw these ancient old growth logs out of the lake and was actually taken to court by the state and charged with stealing state property and
really?
Not allowed to do it anymore. Yeah.
Wow. I didn't know you couldn't go get that. And then then something about a submerged village. Which
yeah.
means what?
This is something I would love to know more about. I just heard a little bit about it while taping the story, but apparently that is also off of St. Edward's Park, and it would be an old Native American village that, again, dates to the similar times of those landslides. And I guess some archaeologists who are associated with St. Edward's Park have reason to believe that there may be a village down there, and that these divers who I talked to, they said they've scanned the whole lake with sonar, and that their sonar findings are compatible with the idea that that could have slid into the lake. So I guess that's a topic that needs some more research.
KUOW reporter Sarah Waller filling in our Week in Review panel. We're all listening to this. It's just all interested. What do you guys make of this?
I want to know who these explorers are and how they find the time to map the bottom of the lake and dive down there, because they're not employed by the state, as I understand it.
That's right. No, these guys are passionate guys. One was retired. There is a couple guys who just have day jobs, and this is certainly not their primary job. They do it at night. They say they're out, in the evenings and on weekends. They say they're out there about every week diving down there, and they've been doing it for about, I think, 8 years.
So how deep is it?
It's just a little over 200 feet, depending on the season.
So not 1,000 feet.
Deep. Not 1,000 feet. And I guess the bottom is inky black, and it's covered with up to 6 feet of this murk.
Right. So where's the bottom exactly?
Yeah.
And what is the water quality? I mean, people swim in that every day, and they, you know, they're not wearing protective clothing, hazard suit, bathing suits. What, can we swim there without, like, getting growths?
Well, now, those are two questions. Getting gross, maybe. I don't know. But the water quality, I guess, now is better than in the 50s when it was actually closed for a while.
In the 60s, it was called Lake Stinko.
There you go. Right. Yeah. So, and I grew up swimming in this lake.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I remember the pre-Metro Lake Stinko. Everybody swam in the lake. I mean, that didn't prevent people from swimming in the lake, but occasionally... I remember seeing, you know, toilet paper and whatnot drifting by. I mean, it was ghastly. So you'd get away, get out. When
did you
saw
ever get
like
sick?
That. No, I never did. I mean, the worst thing over the years occasionally has been sort of lake itch.
Lake itch.
But, you know, by and large, you know, it's really swimmable and great recreation lake. My father grew up here also, so I remember his stories about when the lake, I mean, he remembered the lake, of course, dropped. The lake shore is lower than it was before they built the ship canal, which lowered the lake many feet. And I enjoyed as a kid hearing his stories about how the landscape was different. He used to play in the Genesee wetland where the Stansayers pits are. It used to be an island there. Mm-hmm. So it was a landscape that was always very intriguing and some degree full of mystery. I remember after the 1965 quake, there were sightings of somebody thought there was a creature in the lake, very mysterious, kind of like up in Lake Okanagan in Canada, there's Ogopogo. Sort of our Loch Ness mm-hmm. monster. People had all these theories about how the earthquake might have opened a crack and some creature got into the lake. And then years later, a giant sturgeon floated up dead on the beach. And it turned out that when they dated the age of this fish, that they believe it was a fish from the Alaska-Yukon Pacific Exposition that had been released in the lake, had been living there for like 100 years. And they have the characteristic sometimes of floating on the surface, and it was thought that this was what was scaring people. So, I mean, lakes, especially deep lakes like this, are just fascinating things.
And this story got fired up, cranked up, because we have this program called Local Wonders. Somebody called us up and said, "What's down there?" And I just want you to know, we want your questions about Seattle and the Puget Sound region. You can ask at KUOW.org, and your question might just launch our next Local Wonder story. This one was done, and hugely popular, by the way, was done by KUOW reporter Sarah Waller. Thanks a lot for coming in and telling us about it.
Thank you.
KUOW's Week in Review. If the boats don't sink, Washington State might ship a whole lot of coal to Asia. Oregon's not going to do it. We'll talk about that coming up on the Week in Review. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. We'll share some of your feedback here coming up about what you have contributed to the bottom of Lake Washington. But as I was saying, the coal industry in this country is really running out of room. Americans are cutting back on coal. This week, the state of Oregon refused to build a new coal export terminal. Will Washington State be the one to send that coal to burn in Asia? KUOW's EarthFix reporter Ashley Ahern. Welcome to the Week in Review, Ashley.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
First of all, I want to be real basic here. What is a coal export terminal? It only ships coal? What is this thing?
Yes, a coal export terminal is mainly designed to move coal off of trains and onto ships so that you can cover large oceans to deliver your product to market.
And why is it controversial?
People that live along the railroads are worried about things like dust, congestion, and then bigger picture, thinking about climate change and global impacts of burning coal. Coal is the single largest contributor to CO2 emissions globally.
So Oregon said no to this key permit. There, as you've reported so well, Ashley, there are two more proposed terminals, five times the size of what Oregon was considering, in Bellingham and in Longview. What are the odds of these terminals being built here in Washington?
Well, I think that the move by Oregon sent a pretty interesting signal to Washington State, or is sending a pretty interesting signal, but it depends on who you ask. I think the proponents of building the terminal near Bellingham are saying that, you know, they're in this for the long game, and they see the coal market as, despite the fact that coal is now $70 a ton, whereas in 2011, when this project came onto the table, coal was at $130 a ton, so it penciled out a lot more. They're saying they see the long game; things are going to get back there. But globally, coal usage, is pretty stable. So I think at this point, it depends on who you ask. The environmentalists see this as a major move, a really strong and brave move by a state agency in Oregon to say that they are not going to grant the permits to build the pier that would have allowed the coal to be loaded onto barges to then be taken and loaded onto ships and sent to Asia. So the other interesting group that is really following this move closely and applauding it and has a very interesting stake in the coal terminals in Washington are tribes. And tribes have an incredible amount of power in the permitting process for these if the proposed projects impact tribal treating fishing areas, which that was the argument against the pier that was going to be built on the Columbia River. And the terminal that could be built near Bellingham would be directly within usual and accustomed fishing grounds for the Lummi and Nooksack and other tribes of the Salish Sea. So that's kind of the interesting parallel that I see between these two projects and the move that was made by Oregon in terms of the kind of signals it could send for the Department of Natural Resources is it was a very similar decision about a pier for the Gateway Pacific Terminal near Bellingham, for example.
Are we talking about mostly the crabs crawling around off of Bellingham?
I actually have gone out fishing with Lummi tribal fishermen who were pulling up crab pots and saying that the tankers that service the refineries and industry there already at Cherry Point pull up their traps on a regular basis and cause problems. But there's also halibut, salmon fisheries, you know, a lot of different stuff being harvested there from those waters.
To me, one of the interesting things, first of all, the movement against coal trains and people's concerns about oil trains as well reminds me a lot of the sort of grassroots movement against allowing oil tankers in Puget Sound. I think there's a way in which we want to preserve what we have here. And the thing is more global now. And I think part of it is changing the calculation as to what is a public benefit, because you can build a coal port and say, well, this is creating family wage union jobs for, you know, a couple hundred people or whatever it is. But we also know that the carbon emissions from that coal have a direct effect on our fishing industry. And a great example is, you know, the problems they've been having in South Sound with ocean acidification affecting the oyster industry. And they're seeing oyster die-offs and that kind of thing because of ocean acidification. We're kind of the canary in the coal mine on that issue. And so I think that's one of the things here is that is making sure that the states are weighing the benefits so the coal companies don't get the benefit of public policy, but then are completely free of what the consequences are. And that's all laid on us, too.
I had a question for Ashley about who makes the decision in Washington. Is this ultimately up to Governor Inslee, who's made a big point about being someone who wants to push forward in combating climate change?
That's going to be a really interesting, and as I was telling a room full of lawyers and industry folks not too long ago, if you are in the legal business around permitting these projects, you should probably buy your vacation home now, because this is going to go back and forth for a long time. And I think that it does not necessarily come right down to the pen of the governor on this, but it will be an interesting debate, I think, in Washington, unlike in Oregon, where the Oregon doesn't follow this SEPA. They don't apply a State Environmental Protection Act and review environmental review of projects the way Washington State does. So the State Department of Ecology in Washington is doing a really comprehensive review, and they're going to release their own environmental impact statement or study in conjunction or parallel to the Army Corps, which is a federal agency. So then you get this sort of question, which I think is the key legal question here, of is the state review and the findings there going to trump the federal review, which is much more narrow in scope and only looks at the environmental impacts immediately surrounding where this terminal is going to be built. It does not look at climate change. It does not look at vessel traffic or train traffic throughout the region. So it's, I think it, you get this really interesting look at, you know, how much power the Fed's going to have and international commerce going to have over the interests of the state in this instance. And I don't see the governor having the final say on this necessarily, but he's certainly a powerful voice and has made his feelings pretty clear on this.
I have a question for you too, Ashley. I mean, if Washington and Oregon both say no, then what happens?
So I think that the proponents of coal are saying, well, it's going to go north, and we're going to see the train traffic anyway going through the state of Washington, because the train route goes right up through to British Columbia, where there are coal terminals now in operation. And in fact, this week, British Columbia, another coal terminal was approved to be built near Vancouver. But to put this into perspective, Canada has a lot of coal of its own that it wants to sell to Asia and abroad. And they also, the terminal that they approved was for about 4 million tons. The terminal that was going to be built just south of there in Washington State was going to be for 48 million tons. So we're looking at, you know, issues, orders of magnitude in terms of size difference here. So I think that if coal exports are stymied in the Northwest, it's going to be potentially Long Beach and California. There might be seeing coal moving south. There's going to be a heavier burden probably going through the Gulf and the ports there. And I think some of it, yeah, will be moving to Canada, but I think that the argument that, oh, it's just going to go through here anyway and go to Canada is not entirely founded on the facts.
One of the most interesting things to me about this is that the coal will get out one way or another, either through Long Beach or Vancouver, and that Oregon and Washington are essentially making protest votes here, or protest statements. They just don't want to be part of contributing to emissions if they decide not to allow coal to be shipped out of their ports.
EarthFix reporter Ashley Ahern is following this for you. KUOW.org/EarthFix, right, Ashley?
That's right. Thanks a lot.
Ashley, thanks for joining us on KUOW's Week in Review with Eli Sanders and Knut Berger and Maria Lagonga of the LA Times. I'm Bill Radke. Back in a moment. KUOW's Week in Review. Good morning. I'm Bill Radke. Continuing to run down and analyze and learn from this week's top stories with you. Do Seattle TV stations have a right to get surveillance video of the Seattle Pacific University shooter? Como, Cairo, King, and Q13 Fox are requesting a 3-minute clip that reportedly shows the gunman at SPU on June 5th. Pointing a shotgun at one student, then firing on another before being subdued. Eli, who is suing to block the release of that tape?
It's not entirely clear because they're listed as Jane and John Doe's in the legal papers, but as Ansel Hertz at The Stranger reported in a really great feature on this case last week, the people who are suing seem to be family members and maybe students who were affected by the shooting. And they are saying that the video should not be released for a number of different reasons. And what the case ends up turning on is, yes, this question of do the TV stations have a right to the video under the state public records law? And then there's a related and, in a way, more important question, in my view, which is do the stations have a responsibility, even if they get the video, to not air it? The video became a public record when the Seattle Police Department got a copy of it as part of its investigation. And once the video ended up in the hands of a public agency, it was requestable under the Records Act. And so the television stations requested it. And as Ansel reported in this piece in The Stranger, the lowest court to review this, the judge went on a really long tear verbally in court against the station, saying, what value is this? This is, you know, you just trying to grab ratings at 5 and 7 and 11 o'clock on your newscasts. And what does this add to the discussion? And can this potentially create harm? Because there's a theory, not yet verified scientifically, but a theory gaining currency that there's a contagion effect to mass school shootings, that people in psychological distress are sometimes inspired by other school shootings to be copycats. And in fact, the person who committed the SPU shooting, or who is accused of committing the SPU shooting, is said to have really idolized Dylan Harris and, I forget the first name, but Klebold, the people who perpetrated the Columbine massacre, sort of the school shooting in the national consciousness. And so do you have a responsibility as a television station to not put out there material that may end up inspiring the next disturbed copycat shooter who is seeking some sort of twisted sense of fame or infamy for doing this?
Okay, so the right and the responsibility. As relates to the right, isn't this settled law? I mean, don't TV stations get to have surveillance video and they pixelate the faces? And why is this an issue?
Well, it's an issue in part because of the new idea that there is actually a harm connected to airing video like this.
This is a new argument being...
It's a new idea that...
A legal argument.
Well...
We've seen these surveillance videos for a long, long time.
Right. So the argument that there is a contagion effect is old, but is gaining more traction. There's a clear, and this came up a lot in the discussion of Robin Williams and his death, a clear contagion effect to reporting on suicide. There's been a lot of studies, and the media has reacted to this and changed how it covers suicides as a result. But if you cover suicide in a certain way, you can clearly see clusters of suicides related to it. So there's a growing body of evidence and thought that says, well, there's an effect similar for mass shootings. And now someone is trying to make a legal argument that says, well, then if you're balancing the public interest versus public harm, you should keep this video out of the hands of the TV stations. The TV stations say, well, that's our decision whether or not to air it.
Right.
Yeah. Not absolutely everything is available under public disclosure. So they're making an argument that this would meet a standard in terms of the harm that it might do. But I think it is a public record that should be disclosed. You can make, the public ought to make the news organizations should make news judgments, not judges. That would be my opinion.
And I'm pretty much a First Amendment absolutist, and I know that as reporters, we are the gateway for information for the public. You know, the public can't go out and be on a campaign plane, be in a courtroom. So it is our responsibility to get information and then decide what to disseminate. And there are standards about what you can and can't and do and don't show. I mean, the James Foley beheading videotape this week was briefly available. Nobody showed it, and it was even taken down on the internet. So
YouTube took it down as a company. Google and Twitter, I think, is disabling the accounts of people who pass it around.
So I think that there is we should have the availability, but then we should also exercise great responsibility for how much we show.
Although the extent to which media or traditional media is the gatekeeper of information is greatly eroded in, now that the media environment has changed so much. And so you can imagine that if the courts rule that the SPU video is a public record that anyone can get, because it's not just media companies that can make a public records request, then you could see it easily ending up on YouTube,
right,
from just an average citizen who had some interest and then uploaded it. And then anyone in the world would be able to see it. And the question, again, then comes back to the courts, whether it's their proper role to determine whether there's too much of a harm associated with that.
Well, and the remedy is through the legislature in terms of modifying the Public Disclosure Act if people wanted to do that. I mean, I think that's the place where you can specify what gets released and what not, what specifically defines a public harm. I mean, the state doesn't reveal a lot of competitive bid information that might contain proprietary secrets, for example, and they're protecting corporations, and there's nothing that would prevent them from. The problem is it's difficult to write those standards in such a way that while it might seem reasonable in the SPU shooting case, would seem very unreasonable in a use of force case or some other case involving the public. So,
and this is going to come up more and more as more police officers wear cameras, because I mean there are times when this kind of video is necessary for us to see to police the police and other other public public servants. And one good example also recently is the California Highway Patrol officer beating the heck out of a woman on the side of a road. And that video is helping to, keep agencies in line.
So just to update on where this case stands, the judge's sort of tirade that I talked about, where he said, what is the value of this, and really was harsh on the TV stations, that ruling was overturned at the Superior Court level,
right,
by a judge who said, this is clearly a public record, although I hope the stations consider what's in the public interest. And that was appealed by the SPU, by the people associated with SPU, and it's now at the appellate level. And the appeals court has said it is going to consider and rule on this sometime soon.
Yeah, we'll be talking about this again very soon. Eli Sanders at The Stranger, Maria Lagonga, the LA Times, Seattle Bureau Chief, and the Mossback from Crosscut.com, Knute Berger, and you running down and learning from the news of the week on The Week in Review. KUOW's Week in Review. It's a good sign that we're frustrated because we just want to keep talking about every topic as we're moving on to the next one. But we're talking about the top stories of the week and figuring out what they mean. This week, the state announced the voter turnout for this month's primary election, 31%. Even in Seattle, where they voted on a new park district, 33%. Now, in Maine, it was 10%. This year. So it gets worse. But declining voter turnout, some people think, can give rise to more partisan politicians. There are places that require voting. Australia, Belgium, Chile. And voter turnout there is excellent. Near 90%. There is a proposal in your hometown, Maria, of Los Angeles, to look at using cash prizes for voting, right?
Yes, there is. And I sort of don't think that's a horrible idea. I think we should make voting as easy as possible for everybody, because there are pushes now to make it harder, even though turnout is dropping. But there are places like Ferguson this week where we see what happens when voter turnout is incredibly low. Voter turnout in that little town outside of Missouri is 12%. It's a largely black town with an overwhelmingly white power structure, and it combusted this week. So on the one hand, you can say people get what they pay for or vote for or don't vote for, but it's terrible. The outcomes can be terrible when people don't get out. So I'm kind of in favor of get them out however you can.
I strongly disagree with the idea that the government should be giving out cash prizes for voting, but my take on it also starts with Ferguson. And you look at this city or area that has, you know, an overwhelming majority of African Americans and, as Maria said, an almost all-white power structure. And when when all of this first began in Ferguson, I was listening on NPR to an interview with, I believe it was the one African-American or one of the few African-American council members or people in the city government there. And they were saying, why are there not more African-Americans in the power structure here? And she said, well, it's because people don't vote. But obviously, if people voted, you would have a different outcome. So why don't people vote? She said, because they have to work. If you allowed people a voting holiday, you would get a much different outcome. And I think that may be tied to the declining voter turnout that we're seeing as the recession drags on, as people are working more and more jobs, as, you know, voting falls lower and lower on the priority of just making ends meet and getting to work and back and commuting and all of that. You see fewer people able to vote. If you had a federal holiday that was designed around people being able to go and vote or sit and mail in their ballot, then I think you would see different turnout in a way that would be the government paying people to vote or forcing businesses to pay for a holiday for people to vote. But it wouldn't be a kind of like cash prize for voting, which I think has, to me, that's not what citizenship is about.
But what Washington State has mail-in voting, and the voter turnout isn't any higher here. Why has it not? I mean, that was considered to be kind of a magic bullet, and people have talked about having internet voting. They're making it easier. Why aren't people doing it?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, because we've made it so easy, and yet you can't. You know, if Seattle turns out at 33%, I mean, one of the arguments is, I mean, it's only been a few elections now that we've had the summer primary and that people just don't think about politics here in the summer. And we've made it so easy. I think the problem is a kind of disengagement that really needs to be addressed. I don't think there's a simple answer to the question. But to the question of whether we should pay people to vote, I just want to remind people there's a long history in this country basically of getting people liquored up so they vote.
I'm for that.
I mean, you know, William Henry Harrison ran as the cider barrel candidate, and I was reading that George Washington lost his first election to the Virginia House of Burgesses in, you know, 1755 or something, because his opponent put on a big booze party for everybody. And 3 years later, he won election by 300 votes because he gave everybody exactly what they wanted.
Well, the Los Angeles Ethics Commission has not weighed in one side or the other on the booze party, but they recommended that the city of L.A. look at cash prizes, maybe a lottery prize of up to $50,000 for voting. Now, can you separate your desire to have more people vote from your politics? Because there are presumably well-meaning people who think that there ought to be more barrier to voting, or at the very least, if you can't, you know, make the time to vote, yeah, you deserve what you get. In other words, are you sure that your politics, that your desire to see, because isn't voter turnout lower among Democrats than Republicans? Typically, overall, young people don't vote. They vote less. Minorities vote less as a whole. So I'm just wondering, like, you see these people make supposedly theoretical and high-minded arguments, and it seems to often align with their politics. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think the assumption that they're well-meaning to me is problematic. There's a history of intentional voter disenfranchisement in this country, and the the intention behind that was not well-meaning. It was to get a particular political outcome by denying the vote to people.
So do you think everybody's position on how whether we ought to pay to vote or make it easier to vote lines up with their agenda?
Not necessarily, but I do think that there are very clear moments where we see where we see the Republican Party not standing up for measures that would encourage voter turnout because in particular states or districts, it's not in their interest to encourage voter turnout.
And in fact, I mean, you talk about a history of discouraging voting. There's a present of discouraging voting also. In Missouri, where Ferguson is, they have been discussing having a constitutional amendment and been pushing and pushing for it, and it's still in discussion of requiring ID before people will vote. And it is the Republicans there who are pushing for it.
In a democracy where the idea is that everyone who's a citizen has the right to vote and you get the best outcome that way, I don't think that you can argue that there's an equivalence of support for democracy when one side is discouraging people to vote.
Eli Sanders, Maria Laganga, Knute Berger, and Steve Ballmer's latest performance coming up next on The Week in Review. Good morning. I'm Bill Radke with Knute Berger, Eli Sanders, and Maria Laganga of Los Angeles Times. And this week, Steve Ballmer stepped down from the Microsoft board. So he's not the CEO. He's no longer on the board. He just has a few shares of stock. He told Microsoft he wants to focus on his other pursuits, which include taking over as owner of the Los Angeles Clippers basketball team, holding a fan festival in L.A. on stage with the players and coach next to him, and generally making people feel uncomfortable.
Baby, nothing gets in our way. Boom! Keep coming. Hardcore. The hardcore Clippers. That's us.
Ballmer said the Clippers players sitting next to him are not just his employees, they're his friends.
Me and my buddies, my pals, my amigos. You're gonna be doing a lot of doobie rolling when you're living in a van down by the river.
What does that mean?
The fact that you thought that was Steve Ballmer says it all. That was actually Matt Foley from Saturday Night Live, the motivational speaker, but you see. So did any of you watch the video with the Clippers players and coach sitting there through that? They were not allowed to squirm, so I was squirming for them as I watched. I already feel so awkward about non-athletic billionaires who desperately want to be part of sports, that this week's Seattle Times report on Ballmer's time at Lakeside High School surprised me not one bit. Here with the story, Lakeside alum Knute Berger.
Well, yeah. I mean, Seattle Times, it was one of those sort of bombshell weeks for Ballmer with news on every front, and one of it was the Seattle Times story about Ballmer's efforts to improve the Lakeside basketball program using he and other alums getting together and using money to cover expenses for students, to the some of the former coaches at the school, at least one, said that the school had adjusted its academic standards to allow students in. And this goes right to the sort of heart of Lakeside's brand as a place of academic sport, not an intellectual sport, as opposed to sort of selling its standards for basketball. He comes across as sort of the nightmare basketball dad. He had sons on the team. He was apparently, you know, pretty vocal at games, not unlike. And so, you know, one sort of comes to the conclusion that all those ambitions are probably much better used in Los Angeles than out at the Lakeside campus. But
Allow me to play one more piece of audio about this before we open it up. Seattle Times reporter, the guy who did the story, Mike Baker, He talked about how, this is in 2008, Ballmer set out, as we said, to turn Lakeside into a basketball power. And Baker describes a deposition by a guy who's helping Ballmer at Lakeside as Ballmer is sick of his son's school losing.
And he's frustrated with the coach and how terrible the program's doing. And this deposition describes a scene where Ballmer is sort of wanting to make change and says, I'm going to open up a foundation and we're going to get black people in here. And over the span of 5 years, they got a new coach. They got some talented players. They went from worst in their district to champs in their district. They went all the way to the state title game. It was the best finish in school history.
And isn't race part of the awkwardness here from Lakeside to the Clippers to beyond Steve Ballmer?
Well, Lakeside, there's no question, it has a history as a bastion of privilege, and it's done a lot over the years. It has 49% people of color in its student body. It's done a lot to reach out. But there was a previous lawsuit from faculty over the racial environment there. There have been questions over the years, and it raises, awkward questions that the school has had to deal with off and on over the years.
You know, I wanted to talk much more about this, but we have like a minute left. So, Eli and Maria, any more thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at Los Angeles getting Steve Ballmer and getting
your hometown.
Yes, my hometown. I think as a former Angeleno, I can't speak for all of my neighbors, but I think the city feels that a billionaire maniac is better than an ugly marital dispute played out in public with an allegedly addled apparent racist as the team owner.
Right.
And I think great. Have fun with him, L.A.
That's Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger. Maria Laganga, Seattle bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. Knute Berger, the Mossback at crosscut.com and columnist at Seattle Magazine. We had EarthFix reporter Ashley Ahern today. We had KUOW's Sarah Waller telling you what's on the bottom of Lake Washington. By the way, we heard from some of you. Abby says her great uncle gave an engagement ring to her great aunt. She said no. He threw the ring over the I-90 bridge. Later, she said yes, and they were married 50 years later, but the ring is still down there. Way to show her who's boss. Think I'm asking you again? Watch this go. And there's much more at our Facebook page, KUOW Public Radio. Our producer's Jason Pagano. This hour flew by. Thank you, everybody.